intimacy is elusive. It might be something different outside the house than inside the house, and we can get it wrong. And it is far more dependent upon environment than we would like to admit. Well, this passage that we just read teaches us that, actually teaches us what I'm saying now, as it tries to instruct us on a principal way in which we find our identity. So I want to look at it with you this morning. We're reading in this first couple chapters of Genesis. We've been reading for a while. We have one more week back when things were very good. And we're reading about the time when the royal bearers of God's image were walking in, before the time when they fell, that image was broken. They became the broken image bearers that we're familiar with now, that we see in ourselves and others. And we see in these first couple of chapters the origin of many things. We read about the origin of many institutions. And we're finding, aren't we, that when we look at God's creation, we find out a lot about God's character as well as the institutions of our lives. And today, we just read this passage about the institution and the instituting of marriage. Right? We would say from verse 18, at that point, there's still only one hominid on the face of the earth into whom God has breathed the breath of life, formed his divine image. But that was about to change through a profound and divine operation that takes place. Puts Adam to sleep, takes out his rib. And, you know, often at weddings, you hear the little ditty that when God took from Adam, he didn't take from his head, lest she would rule over him, and he didn't take from Adam's foot, lest he would trample on her. But no, he took from her, he took from his rib, so that she would always be around his heart. So whatever that means. It's not something I've ever said at a wedding, but I know it's said. Whatever we're talking about here, it's something very deep, friends. Whatever the point the author is trying to make is, it's something that has to do with the very guts of a man. Something about his identity. And so he does this operation, and he brings the woman, and we witness the first wedding. First wedding here. Right here in this passage, and it's set in the royal temple garden of Adam. God did the flowers. He also gave away the bride. And you know, there's that one moment when Adam is standing there and he sees Eve coming down the aisle, and he utters the first recorded words that he spoke. First recorded words, and they are poetry. There's that special moment when she's coming down. And let me translate the Hebrew for you. Wow. Wow. That's pretty much what the Hebrew is saying. Wow. First time. And something changed in the bones and flesh of Adam. Something got defined. And then in the following verses, verses 24 and 25, we see that sex flows out of this definition. And so what I want to point out to you here first is that we're not only witnessing the creation of marriage, we're witnessing another creation here. And this passage drives us to the understanding that the creation of marriage is inextricably bound up with another creation at the same time, and that's the initiation of human gender. Other gender in animals had existed on the earth, but here it's the initiation of human gender at the same time. And it tells us something, a couple things, a couple observations we can make about that. One of them, it tells us something about God. It tells us that he is neither male nor female. God can't be characterized as one or the other, because they both come out of him. There are, overwhelmingly, the imagery that's used of God in the Bible is male, is masculine. But there are places, Isaiah 66, Psalm 131, God is pictured as a mother. A couple other places. But really, the hard evidence comes from the chapter we read before, chapter 1, where it says that God made man in his image. Male and female created he them. It tells us that male and female both are found in God, that God is not one or the other. And so really what we have here are two flavors of the image of God. God's image comes in two different flavors. And so that's something to contemplate as we look at the meaning of this passage. Another thing I think it tells us, very important, is that in this creation called gender, the genders are defined in distinction to one another. The rib tells us that, just as there's not an Eve without Adam, Adam doesn't come to know himself without Eve. And that's why you kind of picture visually this arrangement, the yin-yang symbol. I know if you can separate it from Taoism there, it's a great visual image of gender. You can't see one part without the other. And that tells us gender is an existence in relationship to the other gender. That's how it's defined. Now, what I want to do is establish two things with you this morning and then talk about the implications and then the applications of them. So two propositions I want to establish from this passage with you. If you're going to listen to what the author is saying, what he's trying to teach here, I want to make two propositions and then talk about what it means for them to go together. The two propositions are this. Proposition A is that marriage is predicated on gender difference. Marriage is predicated on gender difference. And proposition B is that marriage is a place to understand your identity. Okay, so let me just try to establish the first one with you, that this is really what the author is saying. Moses, in verse 24, tells us that marriage is a matter of gender. He says, you see in verse 24, he says, "For this reason, man shall leave his father and mother." Well, he's not talking about Adam and Eve. He's talking about the institution of marriage because they don't have a father and mother. He's saying, for this reason, people get married. Well, for what reason? Because of gender. Because of what he just created. In other words, the man is no longer defined by his parents, but instead by his wife. To find definition in the complement. Jesus is very clear. Jesus is even more clear about the meaning of that for that reason. When he gives his commentary on this verse in Matthew 19, Jesus brings up this verse for this reason, and he goes back, Jesus does, and he yanks out of chapter 1, Genesis chapter 1, the male-female thing, and then rams it up against this verse. So what Jesus says is, God created them, male and female, for this reason people get married. Jesus goes out of his way to make marriage about gender, the meeting of these two flavors of the image of God. Apostle Paul also does in 1 Timothy 2, when he brings up this passage in dealing with marital roles, he brings up this passage and the importance of gender. And even in the next chapter, Genesis 3, when we witness the great fall, and when marriage falls, we find it's very gender specific. The consequences of what Adam and Eve do come out in the place where they, as individually as man and woman, tend to place their deepest significance respectively. So the fall of marriage is gender specific. So what this is saying to us, friends, is that this gift of our most intimate relationship is meant to be across the genders. That's proposition one. Okay. Proposition two, Marriage is a place to understand your deep identity, not the only place, and I'll talk about this a little later, but it's a principal place. And we can see this easily, I think, in the passage. We can see it a number of different ways. Okay, in verse 18, he says, I want to make a suitable helper, a suitable, meaning she corresponds to him, helper. And that word helper, you might have heard before, is a word in the Old Testament that's very often used to describe God. When God says, I'm going to make a helper for Adam, the word helper, well, it's used 19 times in the Old Testament, and 16 out of those 19 times, it's referring to God. So you see, the emphasis here is on the need of the man and the crucial role of Eve in filling that need. What's the need? Well, I would say to you, the need is the man's need to define himself, to find out that elusive, who am I? That's why when she comes and is brought to him, and he greets her. What is his greeting? This is flesh of my flesh. This is bone of my bone. It's about him understanding himself. I can tell you personally that this is how I've experienced it in life. You know, as a single person, I was a lot of things. But if you asked people around me when I was single, you know, to describe me, probably one of the words they would use for me is silly. There are a lot of mature single people here, so I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about me. But I found that in my life, you know, I was bouncing around all over the place. I was silly in a lot of ways. And it took a number of things, but one of them was loving a woman to make me into a man. That was something that took place in me through just kind of what's being described here. So I can see this, and it resonates with me. You know? Again, not that this is the only way to understand yourself. This is the way it worked for me. And that's why you look again in verse 23, what's going on with this naming business? This naming really shows this definition by the other gender also. Because up to this point in the narrative, the narrator has named him only by his relation to the ground, Adama, only by in his relationship to the work that he's doing. But when Adam speaks, Adam names himself in relationship to the woman, right? When he names her Isha, he's also naming himself Ish. Woman is Isha, man is Ish. So you see that in naming her, he's also finding a name for himself. Friends, you don't want to try to spell women a different way. You don't want to go in that direction. You don't want to spell a W-O-M-Y-N instead of M-E-N. That's going in the wrong direction. You don't want to say, well, we want to make, you know, women independent, because you're losing the gender thing. You're losing what gender is about in that. This naming shows how coming together with this other gender defined him and defined her too. And through it, he found himself, found his identity. Okay, so those are the two propositions that I think this text brings before us. Again, one, marriage is predicated on gender difference, and two, marriage is a place, even further we could say, where man finds himself. So reason with me. If you cannot have marriage without different genders, A, and B, if marriage is a place where we understand our identity, then it follows that gender difference is given to us to help us find ourselves. You see, that's why marriage was made. to combine these two flavors so that you find your identity. You know, you need the strawberries to bring out the taste of the champagne. Okay, we have one champagne drinker here. You need, how about that? You need the garlic to bring out the olive oil, right? And you need the olive oil to bring out the garlic. No? Okay. You need the peanut butter to bring out the richness of the chocolate. How's that? There's a lowbrow example. You see what's going on. Or as someone in this church put it, love is a many-gendered thing. All right, those are the propositions I would put before you. And when we put them together, it brings there are implications. So let me take a few minutes now just and bring out some implications for us from this, okay? This is why, my dear friends, same-sex unions are wrong for you and for me. There's a loss of gender there because a gender is defined by the other. So in same-sex unions, there's a failing to find your real identity as a man and as a woman. If you make your most intimate relationship a same-sex relationship, then you're not getting defined in the ways that God made you to be defined. It's a way of getting the identity wrong. Now, this may be difficult to believe for people who are in a homosexual relationship. It's hard for them to maybe accept this. If you're here and you're in such a relationship, it may be hard for you to accept because of the benefits that you see in the relationship. You know, there's confusion over the word lifestyle, I think, now. People say, oh, they're in the gay lifestyle or coming out of the gay lifestyle. What exactly does that mean? Because for some people, that means just being in a same-sex relationship. For other people, it means a lot of other stuff, like a lot of promiscuity that's going on in some circles. You know, and I know you don't really see the promiscuity these days in the media, but well, let me assure you that promiscuity is alive and well in the gay scene. But that's not what I'm talking about this morning. I'm talking about people who want to be in a monogamous, you know, committed relationship. Just talking to those people. You might be in a same-sex relationship. And this might be difficult for you to accept what I'm saying. And if that's so, I want you to look with me at verse 9. Okay. Verse 9 tells us that all the trees in the midst of the garden were good for food. Right in the middle of the garden, friends, there's a tree called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which we're going to look at actually in a couple of weeks, which God forbid them to eat from. But I want you to know that tree had fruit, according to this passage, that was good for food. That was good for food. It was still forbidden. It was still forbidden. You know, in the next chapter, that's what Eve uses to justify what she does. She looks at the tree, she says, this is good for food. And in fact, it's pleasant to look at. All of these are good things. So why not? Still forbidden. And there are things that we can be involved in this life that give pleasure. I'm sure that when Eve took that fruit and ate it, it tasted good. It was pleasurable. Well, it's hard to fathom that might be something that God says, no, this really isn't good for you. I mean, pleasure is good. And I would go even further. I would say as she was chewing on that fruit and swallowing, I would even say that there was probably some nourishment being given to her body. I would go that far. Still forbidden. Because while she was chewing it, while she was getting nourishment from it, it was killing her. The same is true of same-sex unions, I would say. You might look at them, at some, and say, you know, there are great benefits to this. And there are, you know. You can, there are benefits to any relationship by God's common grace. Good things that come of that. Certainly there are. Especially if you have been rejected by your family, if you have been isolated by your desires, of course there's comfort in that. Of course there is comfort in that relationship. There are things that really help. It's still forbidden because ultimately God is saying this is not what is going to help you find who you really are. Ultimately, this is stunting you. It's stunting your gender. Because making your most intimate relationship the one of the same gender means a loss of gender. Now, let me draw one other implication for us here in terms of how we look at all of our relationships to help us. Then talk a little bit about applying this. In certain relationships in our lives, gender comes into play. In other ones, it does not. And it has to do with the intensity of the relationship. For example, in the marketplace, in the workplace, or in the body politic, gender does not come into play. Gender shouldn't matter in the gender of a person running for office shouldn't matter. I mean, women and men are going to bring different things to their roles. For example, men are dense. I mean, literally dense, actually. In the temporal neocortex, researchers in Spain have recently found men have more neurons. Okay, they're more dense in that area, which is probably why men are better generally at spatial perception. And women can talk faster and remember more of what they hear, probably. But there are differences, obviously, between men and women. They're going to bring that to their roles. But you can evaluate that. But gender shouldn't really matter because in the body politic, relationships aren't intense enough. They don't reach the level of defining our identity. It's same with the workplace, you know. It's a one-dimensional relationship that you share with people in the workplace. You know, you're there to cooperate to get a certain job done, a certain bottom line. It's one-dimensional. Gender should not play a role. Now, when you come into the church, your relationships are meant to be closer. They're meant to be fuller. They involve more of your identity. And so guess what? Gender matters. In the church, there are certain roles that we take that have to do with gender. Okay? And in the most intense relationship of all, that of marriage, gender really matters. And that's why in the New Testament, all instruction that's specifically said to be about marriage is gender-related, it's gender-specific. Instructions are different for men, for husbands, for wives. Both share the image of God, but with different steps in the dance, different flavors. And when a marriage works the way it's supposed to, you find your deep identity and you find it gendered. Okay, I'm speaking in general ways about how to look at relationships, but that's an implication that we should draw from this, I think. Now, this is an answer for us. How come it's not right to have our most intimate relationship be same sex? You say, because it's not the way in which we really find our identity, which is a difficult thing to find. But let me go even deeper than that. There's a deeper reason for this. Why this is. If you look at verse 24, it says that, it's talking about them coming together, Adam and Eve coming together. It says they're united. They're united. Very interesting, because it's the author is speaking in covenant terminology. He's talking in the language of covenant commitment. That's significant in this book because this book is all about covenants being made. The book of Genesis has four different covenants. And the covenants that are made are between God and his people as an expression of love between God and the people that he is working with. Four different times. So in this passage, to use a kind of covenant terminology, it's inviting us to draw a parallel between what's going on between a husband and wife and what's going on between God and his people. There must be something, then, about this first relationship, about the creation of gender, that's crucial to the covenant of God with us. And let me cite again Warren Austin Gage, whom I cited last week, has wonderful insights, I think, into this first, the early chapters here of Genesis. And he points out that, if you'll notice in verse 21, how this bride was formed for Adam. We see that Adam's side was wounded to make this marriage. Was wounded in order to make this bride. And so also with the last Adam, Jesus Christ, he was wounded in his side on the cross to secure and constitute his bride. John tells us in John 19 that a spear was thrust into the side of Christ on the cross, and out came blood and water, blood to purchase the church and water to purify the church. The first Adam and the last Adam, a wound in the side to create the bride. God puts the first Adam into a deep sleep in order to make his bride. God put the Son of Man into an even deeper sleep, the sleep of death, to form us, his people, his bride. And Adam awoke, he beheld his bride in all her perfections. And Jesus Christ, in a way, awoke, he rose from the dead. And the resurrection that will flow from that, in that resurrection, he will see his bride perfected. You see, friends, what this is saying. This is all about God's love for us. This is all about what God would do so that we could be defined. He will be wounded for us. He'll be wounded so that we could be rescued out of this swirling chaos of self-confusion that we've lived in. That God would go to this length, he would go to any lengths. He would take the wound in order to form us as a people, in order to give us an identity, the very identity that we needed. That's what all this is about. And in marriage, in a marriage relationship, we imitate that gospel. That's why this is important. That's the real reason. So that we can preserve the understanding in our lives and imitate it of what God has done for us to make sure that crazy amorphous thing called our identity is secured. And that's what Jesus does on the cross. He secures our identity, defines us as his bride, as those who are loved by him. Okay. Briefly now, let me try to apply these things, just help you to think about how to take this and obey it. Because, you know, this passage gives us something to obey, calls us to action. Let me give you three ways to obey here, to serve God in light of these things. Okay, first thing to do is help marriages. Be sure to honor this institution. And, you know, so much to be said here, but let's just say, if you're a wife, Look, Christ requires singular fidelity from his church, even greater loyalty than to father and mother. Trust in him. If you're a wife, trust in your husband. Give singular fidelity to him, trusting in him, even more than parents. If you're a husband here, be wounded for your wife. Every day, get up in the morning and take the hit for her. Every day. And corporately, support the coming of people together in marriage. You know, we certainly do that as a church here. In fact, we take more personal effort with couples that are getting married here than any other church that I know. Why do we do that here? Because of this passage. Because we understand how important marriage is. We want to make sure they're supported from the very beginning, that they're strong. Not that, you know, I do this with my wife in our sessions, but not like we're great marriage counselors or anything, but we're going to give you everything we got. Because of the importance of this. So anyway, help marriages. That's number one. Number two, we need to help single folks develop their gender identity. Now, some of us maybe need to be encouraged toward marriage. You know, that you have kind of set up your life in a certain way. Maybe you've gotten a little bit too comfortable in setting it up, being comfortable being single. Some people need to be encouraged in marriage. But some people don't get married. Not everybody gets married. And if you're here and you're single, you might be asking, well, where do you get your gender identity developed? And so if you've been listening to the implications of what I've been saying, you should see it. First of all, you need to understand that God has given you families as places to discover who you are. It's very important. And so your family is a gift to you, however imperfect, as a place where gender does come into play, those relationships, gender does come into play, and it matters. That's why, you know, as far as causes of homosexuality are concerned, factors in families continue to be, it's complex, but factors in families continue to be discussed as important. In fact, right now, the research is going on is talking about birth order in families as an important factor. Very interesting. But, so that's something for you to know. And it's something for us to respond to. As parents, we need to realize the role that we're playing in our children's lives, in defining their gender and helping them understand who they are. It's these inter-family relationships that are so important. And this is very important. If you're here and you're single, I want you to know, I want you here in the Village Church, that you belong here. Okay? Don't let all these babies fool you. Yeah. Think that make you feel out of place. Instead, sign up with Rebecca for the Halloween festival. Because you need some kids in your lives. And actually, more than that, they need you in their lives. That's an important thing to do. But, you know, more than that, if you're single, you need to know you're not second class. You know, if God has another track for you, it's a good one. And it's also one of self-discovery. But the church is a place to find it, you know. A church is a place where gender also comes into play. It matters. And that's also where we find out that we're men and we're women. I'll tell you, it worked that way for me when I was single. The church was very important in helping me learn to express myself and learn what it was to be a man, to find out who I was in a gendered way. So you're important to me. You know, you're in the image of God. And I understand this. The church is one of the main places for you to be exploring your gender identity. And so that's number two. Number three, friends, one more. We need, as a church, to embrace people who struggle with same-sex attractions. We need to. Friends, that's why we're volunteering at the Bailey House You know, that's why we're wanting to give to the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center. It's because when you embrace someone, you take on their problems as your problems. Okay? So the problems of the gay community are our problems. And so we need to be doing in all these different ways what we can to assist these people. It's certainly not turning them away. It's a heartbreaking story of Josh and Josh's friend there, because I think it's the experience of many people. We need to offer compassion to the confused. We need to assist those who struggle, to walk with them, to explore with them what it means to follow Jesus when you have the struggle and you maybe want to change and you get absolutely no support from your culture. To affirm to them that God does not tell you and give you commands that are impossible to keep. That there is hope. Where he commands, he empowers. And to help those people who want to be following Christ's teaching about intimate relationships, give them a place where they can reaffirm their gender. Help them stand against defining themselves by their desires. To know that the body of Christ really does care. And that's why, you know, finally, that's why we ask the question, are you game? And we're going to be having more discussion downstairs about this. GAME is our gender-affirming ministry ensemble. That's because, friends, somebody in the city needs to stand up and say, come here. You have an alternative here at the Village Church. And you might say, well, you know, this is a controversial subject. Why should we be doing this? Why do we need to do it? Because we can. Friends, we have the theological weight here to be able to provide reasonable answers for the questions the culture is asking. And we have the heart of more than one man in the Village Church who struggles, for whom this is a struggle, knows what the struggle is about. And we also have the heart, I think, in all of us, a willingness now to live for others. We have Jesus Christ, friends, so we have it all. That's why we can. So let me encourage you, think upon these things as we come to the table. Enter into the love of God's created gifts and know yourself. Amen. Would you please stand with me?